You're listening to the Mojo Matters podcast with me, your host, Jo Britton. Your mojo is your energy, your enthusiasm, and your motivation so that you've got the ability to get results for your personal and professional life without freaking out and burning out. Tune in for practical advice on how to find your mojo and keep it. It's woo-woo. I don't really have time. Oh, it's for hippies. It's a bit weird. Oh, I can't do it. It's not for me. You have to sit in silence and clear your thoughts. Here are just some of the things that you might hear when it comes to mindfulness and meditation. On this episode, I'm joined by mindfulness coach and the fabulous Anna Preece. We're going to be talking about meditation and mindfulness, what it is, dispelling a few myths, because both Anna and I are really big fans of this practice, because there are some huge benefits as well. And a lot of it is actually grounded in evidence and science that people may not be aware of. But also how just in a few minutes or even a few seconds a day, you can get enormous health benefits. It can help you with focus, productivity, and other mojo boosting benefits from these practices as well. So Anna, thank you so much for joining us on Mojo Matters and welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you so much for having me. What an introduction, I love it.
So Anna, you're a psychologist, aren't you, by background? And I know when we've chatted before, you've done some absolutely amazing work, particularly with children in inpatient departments of mental health hospitals. How, though, did you get into mindfulness and meditation?
Such a good question. So, yes, I've done my undergraduate in psychology, and I originally always wanted to work with children. And it's funny because during my entire degree, I don't think meditation was mentioned once, or if it was, I was not interested at all. It went right over my head. I was like, no, that's not what I want to do. I was really focused on precisely what I wanted to do. I wanted to go into like behaviour change with children, stuff like that. And then I came out of university and I started working in a children's mental hospital. What a learning curve. So straight from university into the workplace, and it was a lot. It was so children with a variety of mental health diagnoses, so autism, learning disability, eating disorder, whole range, quite complex. And it's a really, really intense environment. So I started off just a support worker, and over the time I was there, kind of rose up a bit, senior support worker, key worker, did some assistant psychology work there as well. And at no point again throughout this time was mindfulness and meditation spoken about. It was still not something on my radar at all. But near the end of this time, so it got more and more intense. It's a very, if anyone's worked in that kind of role, it's a really intense environment. You are running on adrenaline. The alarms go, incidents happen. I was the restraint instructor at the time as well. So managing incidents, making sure that everybody's safe, and it's so much. And looking back, the mindset I was in was completely different. And I got to a stage where I wasn't sleeping. It's not just a case of I was waking up in the night. Sleep just didn't exist for the last few months that I was working there. Tried everything. My stress levels were constantly high. My relationship with food was terrible. I wasn't eating. I wasn't sleeping. I was erratically spending. It was not a good place for me. And I didn't really recognize this as much. It was more around the sleeping. I was like, I have to be able to sleep. I'm just going crazy. Like, I would come home from a day of incidents and then people would just phone me for hours to talking about them again. So my mind was just all over the place. But I started getting into mindfulness around then for me, to help me sleep, bring a little bit of sanity back to my life and a little bit of, I guess, healthiness. And so I started getting into that and I got into it more and more, and I changed jobs, which was even more eye-opening, because a lot of the time when you're in those situations, you never recognize them for what they are. It's only when you've come through it and you're on the other side of it that you really do. And so I got into it more and more, and I was like, why wasn't that something that was taught to staff members as a way for them to cope with their mental well-being? Because what you go through day in, day out, you need, you need something. But then also to support the individuals that we're working with. If we had those tools and they had those tools, it wouldn't have been everything, but that as a baseline would have been incredible. Just when people are more stable, go through those different techniques and build those relationships with your thoughts. So I decided, as I generally do when I kind of get something in my head, that I wanted to be qualified in it. I wanted to extend my knowledge for myself, but also for the people I was working with. So I'd move into another job, still working as an assistant psychologist. This was kind of autism diagnosis, and really good, really interesting, loved it. And then lockdown happened and fully threw myself into it. I was doing meditation when I woke up, but then also as a, I was working from home. So as like a way to break up my day to the evening and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So that's really how I got into it. Yeah, I went from being completely oblivious, even with that background in psychology, to it being something that I think is so fundamental to everything. And I kind of bring it to everyone I work with in terms of people within the NHS services, but then also people who I work with outside of that. It's something for everyone. And that is what I can, yeah, that's what I massively believe.
I agree. And it's how I really discovered the true power of mindfulness and meditation, and particularly as somebody that's had a very, very busy corporate job that I burned myself out in without actually realizing. And then also starting a business, and then the pandemic hit and it was locked down and I was just not in a good space at all. And having tried to access the GP and I couldn't, because it was locked down. So what am I going to do? And I found, you know, I think we'll dispel some of the myths in a minute, but I tried things like meditation before and felt like a huge failure that I couldn't do it. You know, I couldn't clear my thoughts. That was the perception that I had. In fact, all those introductory points that I made at the start of the podcast, those were all things I'd said about mindfulness and meditation. So let's just clarify for people what actually is mindfulness and what problems can it help people solve?
Absolutely. So mindfulness at its very core, when you break it down, is simply awareness of the current moment. That's literally all it is. So if I break down mindfulness and meditation quickly, because some they're used interchangeably, there's a slight difference that sometimes confuses people. But mindfulness is when you bring that into your everyday life. Meditation is when you set that specific time aside to do that with your thoughts. So that's the typical practice that you generally might see people kind of sitting there with their legs crossed, focusing on something, all zen. But the mindfulness is what you bring into your everyday life. So you could be like, you know, when you're in the gym and you've got that pure focus in the moment, you can't think about anything else. That in itself is a form of mindfulness. It's overcomplicated a lot, but if you break it down, it's very basics. That's all it is.
Okay. So let's talk about some of these myths maybe then around meditation. Mm-hmm. And let's maybe see if we can bust a few of them as well. So shall we start with that first one? Because I hear this quite a lot, and especially because we have different practices, don't we? And we'll share some of those as well, because there's loads of different ways that you can meditate as well. And maybe that's confusing for people too. But there are a lot of people, especially when I work with corporate organisations, who are a little bit like, oh, this is really a bit woo-woo and it doesn't really do anything. And so shall we start with some of like the evidence and some of the science, really, how people, whatever sphere of life you're in, how you can benefit from it.
Absolutely. So it is, yeah, it gets completely mixed up with this spiritual practice, which it does have its background from, because it obviously originates from kind of Buddhist traditions. But when you break it down to the research that's been done and the evidence that's out there, your brain physically changes. So the courses that I generally do and base my course on are 8 weeks long. Your brain physically changes over those 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. This isn't something that people are making up. It's not just a case of fake it till you make it, state of mind. It changes your reactions to things, your ability to respond rather than reacting to things, have being able to take that moment, have that time and gap with your thoughts where you can recognize it and build that relationship with it. It's like the, I love the, like, you know, when you get cut up by a car and people's first response is, I'm going to get so close behind him. Like, I'm going to show him who I am and you don't cut me up when you're driving. But having that skill of mindfulness, your brain physically changes. And if you're someone who does that, your automatic response after practicing mindfulness be like, actually, it's fine. It's honestly, it's fine. I don't want to crash into the back of him. He can go do his thing. And you can make that response rather than reacting initially. So that's, yeah, I lost my train of thought.
Yeah, there's loads of scientific research being done into this all the time, isn't there? And I have a practice called neurosculpting, and that's great. And it's grounded in the neuroscience around this, based on, in our practice, we use like a whole brain approach and harness brain's natural neuroplasticity, which is the way that we learn things and we wire these sort of patterns and things like that. So that whether that's your stress and anxiety pattern that you've wired, you can physically change that through a practice, using meditation. You know, we guide it in ours, and we use certain techniques to do it. But you're absolutely right. There are so many scientific studies that show how the brain does change as a result of it. And this is why we see elite athletes and performers as well often use forms of meditation for focus, to help them focus. Because you're absolutely right. In those, and we all have them, I call it the Frankenstein moment. So the fight, flight center of the brain that you're describing, really, weren't you, when the car cuts you off. Mm-hmm. It's that immediate, like, I want to fight or flee moment. Mm-hmm. When we're feeling stressed, because our brain thinks our life is under threat in those moments, and it activates Frankenstein and we just react. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the more that we can practice through mindful and meditative techniques to calm the Frankenstein, to calm the fight flight center, we're actually really also doing our body a lot of good as well, aren't we? Because in those fight flight moments, we're elevating stress in the body, aren't we? Because the body is reacting to, I need to respond, I need to fight, I'm going to pump cortisol and adrenaline around the body to do that, to help you do that. And of course, a lot of us these days are, I guess, in jobs like the job you were describing, like very demanding, high pressure job situations, or navigating just daily life at the moment with things where we're living in a stress response, aren't we? That's not good for the body, and it's elevating blood pressure, and it's pumping the neurochemicals around the body, and it gives us like a shortness of breath and a racy heart, doesn't it? And the longer that's sustained, we're lowering our immune system. And we're setting ourselves up for longer term, more serious health conditions. So I think if there is anybody out there who kind of doubts that or thinks this is just a bit woo-woo and there's nothing in it, go and read some of the research and scientific papers on it, because there are huge benefits, aren't they? So how about myth number two then? I know you're really big on this because I've seen you on your Instagram stories when you do this, that some people think that they need to put aside hours every day to meditate, or they need an hour or even 20 minutes. I don't have time to sit still. I mean, that's a myth in itself as well, isn't it? You don't have to be still with that. Yeah. So it's not true, is it? So say you're really, really busy. Mm. What can you do with even in a few seconds? I know you have different techniques, don't you? Different practices.
You can do so much. It's so funny because people consistently underestimate the small things that you can do with everything. And this stuff, it's like they'll spend ages like reading all these books and being like completely overhauling their diet. literally moments. If you do moments each day of a time, is it Dr. Richard Davison? No, he's a professor. Anyway, I was on a talk with him and he described it as the, if everybody was mindful for the same amount of time they brush their teeth, so we spend more time on our dental hygiene, brushing our teeth each day, than we do on our mental well-being. And if everybody just spent that same time being mindful, the world would be a different place. It's you don't have to, okay? You can incorporate it into other things. That's the magic of mindfulness. I'm not saying be on your phone and pretend you're being mindfulness at the same time. I'm saying be really present in what you're doing. So you're eating a meal with your family. Practice mindfulness in that moment. You'll get so much more enjoyment from the food. You'll remember the conversations you have with your family. You'll be more interested. You'll know what's going on. When you're brushing your teeth, how does it feel in your mouth? Like, what's the taste? How's it feeling? Be really present in that moment. You don't have to set aside hours. You really, really don't. It's incorporating it into your life in a sustainable way. Nobody, I mean, hopefully most people I know don't have terrible breath, like sacrifices their dental hygiene. So why are you sacrificing your mental well-being? Incorporate it into all of those things. Start so small, like reading one page a day really mindfully, and then gradually over time you'll start to become more natural, and you'll start to get used to having that relationship with your mind and being more present. And over time, the compounding effects of this is amazing. Honestly, I generally think, like, mindfulness, everybody do it, it could change the world. The fact that people don't, and we carry on, society at the moment is built for the opposite. We're built for mindlessness and do more and be more. But actually just flipping it for a moment a day and gradually building on that, it's completely life-changing.
Yeah, I love that, because actually what you've just described, when you think about it, are everyday things that we're doing. So we're just getting busier and busier. So, you know, if you're a busy executive and it's like, oh, I've not even got time for lunch. So you eat it on the go, don't you? You might be running from meeting to meeting, having a sandwich whilst you're getting there. But actually, if you just took that, like, even 5 minutes to sit down, chew your food, taste it. What does it taste like? Mm-hmm. How does the texture feel in your mouth without doing your messages at the same time? Actually, that's mindfulness is what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah. And you will show up. So say you're rushing from meeting to meeting. You're too busy. You've only got 5 minutes. If you spend those 5 minutes being truly mindful, you'll show up as such a better version of yourself to that next meeting you go to. You spending that 5 minutes on your phone being mindless, you show up to your next meeting with that really full mind, lots going on, you're not as present. The difference you make, I think that's another thing people underestimate, that I have to do this and then I have to do that and then I have to do that. But actually, you're bringing all of that stuff to each meeting, whereas just sitting there, being with your thoughts, just for those moments, you are a better person at each position. So it's still benefiting you, even in those short moments.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the other thing as well is because actually our brains get so super tired, don't they? Like in today's world where everything's on all the time, you've got, you know, emails pinging, social media pinging, you're rushing from meeting to meeting, you've been sorting the kids out in between, you've been, you know, literally it is nonstop. And I talk about this with my clients, my stressed out business owner clients or professionals or executives, where it's like, you know, you think you're being productive when you're doing all of this, but the prefrontal cortex, this part of the brain, gets exhausted really, really quickly. And so you're not able to focus. You're not able to be as productive if you just don't. And essentially what you're saying when you say be mindful and mindless with your thoughts for a few minutes is you're actually giving that part of your brain a rest as well, and refueling it and recharging it, so that when you go into whatever it is, environment, next task, meeting, your brain's had a little bit of fuel again to be able to focus. Okay. Myth number three, maybe we've talked about this a little bit, just with that last that last discussion, but you have to clear your mind of thoughts, otherwise you're really wrong. Now, this was something that I had a perception around, that I had to sit there very quietly And then, of course, thoughts do what thoughts do, don't they? And so, oh my gosh, I shouldn't be thinking this. So I'm failing. I can't do it. I give up. More stress than when I started.
Yeah. It's that judgment on yourself. You're just adding more. Creating thoughts is what your mind does. So if you're like 20, 30, 40, for the past 20, 30, 40 years, your mind has been creating thoughts. It's not going to suddenly stop just because you sit down for 2 minutes and start to notice it. Like, it's what your mind does. It's what it's always going to do. Some are true, some are false, some are right, some are wrong, some are good, some are bad. It doesn't matter. It's just
what it does.
That's what's going to happen. That's what it does. And one of the main pillars of mindfulness, there's 9 main pillars, but one of them is non-judgment. And a lot of people come with, it's also not, one of them's also non-striving, but they come to meditation and they're like, I'm going to sit down. I'm going to have a clear mind. I'm going to feel really relaxed and amazing. And that's not how life works. If you've had a really stressful day, if stuff's been going on, if your mind is worrying, sitting down for 2 minutes isn't going to clear everything, but it will help you build that relationship, and showing up and still spending that time with your mind and your thoughts will still be beneficial for you. Not every meditation session has to be relaxing. And sometimes they won't be. It will be frustrating. It will be annoying. There'll be times where you're just like, oh my God, why is this taking so long? And that's normal. And the thoughts will come and go. I will say with this, sometimes if people have gone through trauma or something like that, it can be worth doing something different, or making sure that you're engaging with other things. So maybe doing more mindful walking rather than just sitting with your thoughts, or speaking to someone else, because sometimes just sitting there, if it is that really high level thought that you're experiencing, it can be quite hard to work through, especially if you're new to it. So engaging in those other activities as well. But generally, sit there. Though it's like going to the gym. You don't go to the gym and expect every session to be hitting PBs. That's not how it's going to work. But you still show up every day. And that is what makes a difference over the long term. And it's showing up to those sessions where you're struggling, you've got a lot going on, that will really help you make the difference. Mm. And they will over and afterwards. You may not feel mega relaxed and like you've just been on holiday. That's okay. But even if you just feel 1% better.
Yeah. And it's funny, you use the gym analogy. I use that one a lot as well with clients. And also in the sense that this is practice, isn't it? You know, and it is like if you go to the gym, you know, the more you go to the gym, the more you're exercising your muscles, the stronger they get. And you see over time better results, don't you? And for us, for a lot of people that are maybe slave to their minds, we've got these rooted patterns, haven't we, that you know, to change them takes that practice and the same effort. You're working your mind muscle in the same way as your other physical muscles in the body. So just keep practicing. You're not going to get it right every single time, are you? But over time, it's how you were saying right at the beginning when you're saying physically you're changing your brain when you're doing it. So the more you practice, that's, you're strengthening those muscles, aren't you, as you do it. So there's only one way to meditate. Maybe people have seen, you know, it's the picture, isn't it? The lotus position.
Yeah.
There's
sat there in the sun, looking really pretty, really Instagrammable. The reality is, I meditate. It depends where it is. Generally, greasy hair before a shower, sat either on my bed or on my floor. And it changes what type I do. But you can do whatever feels good for you. And what I always say to people at the beginning, so on my courses, I go through different forms and it's finding what works for you. Mm-hmm. Everybody is different and you are the expert on yourself. You just need to check in and kind of recognize that a little bit more. So try different things. So you can do walking meditations. So when you go for a walk, be really mindful. So how does the ground feel under your feet? Can you feel the wind in your face? What can you smell? What can you hear? All of those kind of things. You can do movement meditation. So yoga is a form of this, but it doesn't have to be that energetic. It can be really slow, simple things like moving your head from side to side and just really recognizing how that feels. And things like that are often really good if people are struggling and there's a lot going on, or if you're very new to it, because it's anchoring you. So all these different things are anchors. So your senses, different things you can smell and hear. And these all help bring you back to the moment when you get lost with your thoughts, which you will. So whenever you get lost with your thoughts, you just bring it back. But so there's walking, there's the movement. You can have music on in the background if you want to, and then really focus on that. You can, if you want to, just stare at a blank wall. You can do eyes open meditation where you're picking a point. But all of these themes, the theme throughout is that you are in the present moment. And as soon as you notice you're going with your thoughts, you bring it back to the present moment. There are different forms. On top of that, there's so many different types. But this is what I practice in terms of the evidence base and what has been shown to have those proven effects over time. There's not a right way or wrong way of doing it. If your attention is in the moment, you're doing it right. You will get lost with those thoughts, but you recognize it and bring it back. And each time it goes, it's just an opportunity to practice bringing it back to the moment. That's all it is.
Amazing. Yeah, so many different ways to practice.
So many
things, aren't they? Especially, so I like it when you say, like, you know, you can walk, you can do, have music on, you can do, because, you know, for some of us, like, I'm such a big fidgeter, you know, I'm quite a restless person. So for me, I do struggle to sit very, very quietly. For other people, they could find that quite a natural, relaxing thing to do as well. So I really like that, you know, you don't have to think of the traditional, I guess, the cliched view of what meditation and mindfulness looks like. How about then moving on out of that space into, because I know that you nutritionist as well, in terms of the study and you're in training, yeah, and you're working towards that. And this is also sleep, and you were talking about sleep, and people struggle a lot, don't they, with sleep, especially when you're under stress. It's one of those things, and yet then it becomes this ever decreasing circle, really, doesn't it? The less sleep you get, the worse you feel, because sleep and nutrition are so important for us. And I do say this a lot to my busy clients, that there are probably like two things really to prioritize, or three things I think to prioritize, is getting good sleep, feeding your brain and body with the right nutrition, and exercise. So tell us then, what would you advise in terms of, as a nutritionist in training, what would you say are some of the really right foods to feed our brain and body cells?
So it's so funny, but it's always the boring things. If you ever hear anything that's like a quick fix, or it's something completely out of the blue that you've never heard of before, I'm not going to 100% guarantee, but 90%, it's a load of rubbish. So in terms of nutrients, people, I really don't like the idea that, I guess, when you're taught at school, is that food is fuel for your body. So like the boys can grow big and strong and all of this stuff, and you need calcium for your bones, which is true, but you also need the nutrients for your brain. That's what your brain is made up of, and this is what we really need. So the basics, obviously water, hydration, omega-3. So in terms of, if people jump onto different diets, so the vegan diet, vegetarian diet, there's nothing wrong with that, but people need to be doing their research. They need to understand that they should then be supplementing other things, because the long-term effects of just cutting out food groups is awful in terms of your brain health. So long-term, you're looking at really like damaging your brain. So there's been a massive influx of people jumping on kind of vegan, vegetarian diets and not actually looking at what they should be taking. And this stuff takes time to show the negative effects, but once your brain's really that damaged, it can be really bad. So omega-3 is definite. It's what your brain is like, it's made up of so much of this. So oily fish or supplementation, fruit and veg, a variety. It's a cliche, but your plate should be looking like a rainbow. It really should. And there's, I come across a lot of people who take a load of random supplements. Do your research. A lot of supplements have a load of rubbish in them, and they're not actually researched for that amount. So be really careful of what you're taking. A really good multi-supplement is really good, because what you need is everything at higher levels. The quality of our food has gone down, so we need to be making sure we're taking more of this nutrients. Do your research. Don't just jump on something because other people are. There is so much rubbish out there. There are so many people who aren't qualified talking about nutrients and recommending all these random and supplements. Some of them have like, they're just like a load of talc and a load of other like Beetlejuice, there's just awful, some of them. So do your research, look into it, but the basics, eat your fruit and vegetables, get the colour, get your oily fish in, drink your water. It's all the very basics. Generally, yeah, eat well. It's all the simple stuff.
Yeah, because
really.
There are,
but
some,
it does make that fact.
Yeah, the way in terms of like, I know I do some of this with some of my clients around brain cell nutrition, and you know, it is actually what is a healthy balanced diet, really, isn't it? In mm-hmm. terms of balancing protein, the right fat, and yeah. carbohydrates,
yeah.
and certain ones that are really good in those areas. So, like, you know, it is why if you go back to a lot of like the phrase, "Oh, fish is good for your brain," people have said that, haven't they? You said that years and years ago.
My mum used to tell me.
Yeah,
I
it's good
for your brain.
This is why.
That.
It is scientific. It helps you with your brain cells. There are some others as well that I particularly enjoy because they've got other health benefits too. Blueberries
amazing, they're really good.
They?
Yeah,
so
they're
good.
Really
for your brain.
Good,
but also because of the antioxidant sort of properties as well. But actually, really good for like preventing wrinkles and things, which at my age now, honestly, I buy punnets and punnets off them. Just, can you have too many blueberries?
The things that are good for your brain, though, do tend to be good for everything else.
Yeah,
so if for some reason you don't want your brain to be on top form, and it's stuff like you can help reduce Alzheimer's and things like this, like it's so important and so underestimated, especially in children. There's some really good, Kimberly Wilson has really good podcasts about this, especially behavior change in children. But the benefits for looking after your brain are ridiculous. Like, there is no reason why you shouldn't. But if that doesn't motivate you, everything that's good for your brain is good for your nails, it's good for your skin generally. Like, it's good for your entire body. So whatever helps you get your nutrients in, do it. And I should say that the research is showing that actually, if you eat a load of takeaways, but then you eat good food as well, it doesn't necessarily balance it out. So try and have that balance. What you're having, I think there's like that 80-20, but what you're having should generally be good food, and then like treat yourself with other stuff.
Yeah.
But don't be cutting stuff out. Like, it's all about balance. It's always all about balance. But yeah. Try and keep that as your number one. Get that rainbow. Try new foods. It could be fun. It can be exciting. Like, try cooking new recipes and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, it always puzzles me now. Now I know much more about this as well. Only because I've had to research and navigate so much stuff because I've wanted to help myself through struggles that I've had. You're kind of like, do you know what? Why is this just not standard?
Why is it not taught at school?
I know. Why isn't it not? You know, like your brain's your really most important organ, because it's without it, you know. I mean, I know we can work and function with half a brain. It is possible to do that, not in the same way.
You don't have to.
But I mean, it is honestly ridiculous that this is not taught from being really, really young. So let's pick up on that then. Because you've mentioned kids, and like, we're quite passionate about this. Why don't we teach kids this stuff? And also, the last 2 years of the pandemic has hit kids and their mental health so hard. How can mindfulness and meditation practices help them? And if there are parents out there listening, what can you do to help and introduce these practices to children, and how will they benefit?
Absolutely. So, as we all know, the past few years have been absolutely crazy. I think coming out of this, the behavioural changes in children will be completely expected. I think nutrition will have changed with everything going on as well, but also not used to people, not used to like socialising with people and stuff like that. So mindfulness and meditation, it's not got an age limit. You don't have to be a certain age. Like I've said, it's being aware of the present moment. And sometimes children can actually be really good at it. So it's embracing that and kind of encouraging that and helping them keep in touch with their emotions. So it's all we're trying to do is teach you to recognise your own mind, recognise how you're feeling, really check in with yourself. And that's all it will be doing. So there's different techniques that you can use. There's some where which I was taught in my training. It's quite hard to describe. If you get them to lie on their back and put a book on their tummy. And so this is a way of getting them to do more deep breathing. So deep breathing can actually be really helpful, help calm you down. So all you can do is lie on the back and then have the book on their tummy and try and make the book rise with their breathing. So easy, so simple. All they're doing is having fun, lying on the floor on the back and making this book go up and down. But in the moment, that is all they're really concentrating on. They are being mindful. They are doing deep breathing. There's some really good resources out there. I think Positive Panda. That's it. That's really good. And it's what my teacher actually went through with her grandson, who had a load of behavior issues at school. And just going through this, the relationship that they can then build with other children, other teachers, if they've been really struggling, because they've got that downtime where they're really kind of in touch with themselves and they're building that relationship with their mind and their thoughts. And then other techniques, it all generally focuses on breathing. So you'll really struggle, I imagine, to get a child to sit there for 10 minutes and just sit there and be aware of their thoughts. But other actual practical things is embracing things they like. So say if they're into butterflies, like just the actual movement of like bring arms up and arms down, but then you incorporate the breathing into that. So as they're breathing in, the arms are going up. As they're breathing out, the arms are going down. And just little things like this that you can incorporate. And again, as you would with anybody, starting really small and just getting used to it and turning it into a game. But at the same time, they're doing mindfulness and that practice can grow. And it's something that will stay with them for life. This is once you've built this relationship and they learn these tools and techniques, it's something they can then turn to as they get older, which we've already kind of covered. Why is this not covered in schools generally? Like, it blows my mind still. But really simple, easy techniques to introduce.
It is. And actually, when you were saying before, it just took me back. You said right at the start when we were talking about kids that kids are probably actually very good at this. And I remember when I think about it, I was very, I'd sit and I'd look at clouds in the sky and I would like just stare at the grass. But yet it was almost like the adults around me were very dismissive of that. It's almost like you're daydreaming too much. Pay attention, focus on this, and it's almost like it gets trained out of you. Whereas maybe when we're kids and, what you're talking about, like with play, through play, they're focused on things, and they're in the moment.
Yeah.
But it's almost like these adults tell us almost like this is bad. You shouldn't be. I mean, daydreaming is an amazing way of stimulating creativity and calmness in the brain, right? But when we're children, mostly we're told off for daydreaming, pay attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's almost like we have these natural gifts actually from being young, and they're pulled out of us and we're told
and then life happens. Them.
And then we end up, with struggling a lot in adulthood with stress and overwhelmed because it's been almost trained out of us to do it.
Yeah. As society, as a general thing, it's like you then have to grow up and do more and be more and do this and do that. And you do lose that in a child. And I've spoken about this before on my Instagram, actually. It's like getting back in touch. There's this kind of spiritual version of getting in touch with the inner child, but actually getting back into playing and having fun and being really mindful with it and like getting outside, jumping around on the beach, stuff like that, feeling the sand in your toes and being fully present in that moment. And it does bring that form of joy again. Like, you can still get in touch with that. It does get drained out, but you can bring that back. And again, it doesn't have to take ages or really long, but coming back to that can be really good.
Amazing. Anna, thank you. I could talk to you all day because we share this passion, don't we, I think, around this stuff.
We do.
So, but if people wanted to connect with you and find out more, where can they find you and how can they do that?
Absolutely. You can find me on annamarie.mh on Instagram. I'm also on LinkedIn as Anna Priest. I don't know the numbers after my LinkedIn
go. Just find you as the mindful coach, mindfulness.
Yeah, actually my Anna Marie, my business page is on there on LinkedIn.
Yeah. Okay. Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you, Jo.
All of your wisdom and practice. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Lovely speaking to you.
You've been listening to the Mojo Matters podcast with Jo Britton. Tune in again for more practical advice on how to find your mojo and how to keep it.